It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. So why all the fuss over heirloom tomatoes? This was the very question tomato breeder Craig LeHoulier asked himself years ago. So he pitted the hybrid against the heirloom.
So I pulled some great-sounding heirlooms out of the Seed Savers catalog, grew them side-by-side, and in a three-year time period of growing maybe over 100 types, convinced myself that hybrids are really good. Heirlooms can be really great, and you get the added distinctiveness of the colors and the nuances. It's almost like wine tasting, picking up all of the individuality characteristics that each tomato holds. And once you start down this road, and it's not a bug that hits everyone, but for those that really get it, there's no end to it, and you just end up on a lifelong quest to grow everything you can get your hands on.
Craig's epic tomatoes, miso lace brownies, and remember the pawpaw patch? All this hour, on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. I have a theory. I think heirloom tomatoes threw open the doors to rethinking what we buy, what we eat, and what we demand to know about our foods. Certainly they changed the life of one home gardener. Craig LeHoulier is called the North Carolina Tomato Man. He's a gardener in Raleigh who says he didn't choose the tomato. The tomato chose him. And in 35 years, he's grown and tasted over 1,000 tomatoes. He develops new varieties and is Seed Savers Tomato Advisor. His new book is Epic Tomatoes, How to Select and Grow the Best Varieties of All Time. Craig, it is so good to have you here.
Well, thank you so much, Lynn. It is an absolute pleasure to be here.
Well, a fellow tomato lover, you know, I could go on and on. Now, you talk about 35 years of growing out and tasting 1,000 different tomatoes. What is it about the tomato? What got you hooked?
Well, it really goes back to my love of gardening that was instilled in me when I was very, very young by my dad and my grandfather. That took me through to maybe right around when I was married to my wife Susan in 1980, when the first thing we decided to do was have our own garden. And of course, the tomatoes that grew in that garden were better boys, because back in 1980, the Seed Savers Exchange hadn't really become well-known enough to induce people to grow all these incredibly wonderful colors and shapes and sizes that have been kept all over the world for years and years. When I joined the Seed Savers in 86, not only my gardening life changed, but my life changed, because then tomatoes of every hue of the rainbow would decorate our tables and adorn our recipes. And nothing has been the same since, Lynn, to tell you the truth.
Oh, I can understand that. Now, you mentioned the better boy, and I think that's a descendant of the big boy. Was it big boy?
Big boy, actually,
yeah. It was the first hybrid.
Yes.
And that
yes.
For gardeners, this was pretty important because it meant disease resistance and that kind of thing. But you talk about you grew side-by-side hybrids and some heirlooms as a test. What came out of the test?
Well, you know, as a scientist in a pharmaceutical company, I do have this laboratory approach to things. And part of it is I love folklore, but I want to prove to myself what happened. So I was reading the catalogs. You need to grow hybrids if you were to have yield and success. I said, that sounds like a challenge to me. So I pulled some great-sounding heirlooms out of the Seed Savers catalog, grew them side-by-side, and in a three-year time period of growing maybe over 100 types, convinced myself that hybrids are really good. Heirlooms can be really great, and you get the added distinctiveness of the colors and the nuances. It's almost like wine tasting when you can start picking up all of the individuality characteristics that each specific tomato holds. And once you start down this road, and it's not a bug that hits everyone, but for those that really get it, there's no end to it, and you just end up on a lifelong quest to grow everything you can get your hands on.
One of the things I suspect, because I'm thinking about in the 30 years that you've been growing those tomatoes, and especially since maybe the 1990s, there has been such an amazing change in the way we approach what we eat in the United States. You know, we question so much. We demand things that we didn't demand before, like flavor. And I wonder if it was the heirloom tomato that ushered in this change or deeply influenced it. And I think if it had been a green bean or a cauliflower, it's just not. I mean, this was a sexy fruit that everybody responds positively to. And I wonder if we could say that that was one of the things that really started people thinking about how their food is grown, biodiversity, and, you know, demanding better fruit.
And I'll add some words to that. History, stories, community. And because, yeah, the tomato is actually the perfect storm of nostalgia. We'd get in the car with our parents or grandparents and take a drive and stop at a farm stand and grab tomatoes. The tomatoes, the heirlooms particularly, come with stories. So in 1990, when I was fortunate to be sent the tomato that I later named Cherokee Purple, that kind of kicked off the black tomato craze. And we've seen since the 90s different colors come in. And now we've got this cornucopia of all colors and flavors. People do demand that excellence. They'll pay premiums at restaurants for heirloom tomato plates. But we have to remember it is a seasonal vegetable. And one of the challenges, in America, we are very accustomed to having every fruit and vegetable 365 days a year.
Yeah.
To get the absolute excellence of tomatoes, it's kind of like strawberries, blueberries, these fleeting moments. And that's why I really don't eat another tomato between my last one picked in, say, September and the first one picked in June, unless they're canned, sun-dried, preserved in some way. Because, you know, the tomatoes off-season, people are doing a wonderful job improving them, but they're still not the same. And they're very perishable.
Yeah, but I think some of the best things in life have to be fragile.
Absolutely.
We appreciate them more.
Yeah.
You have a top 10 list of your 10 favorites. Could you give us an idea, maybe three of them for us to hunt down or contemplate at least?
Sure. Well, I'll start with one that's quite easy to find, and it's Sun Gold. Two words, Sun Gold. It's a hybrid that first came out in probably the late 80s. And I would love to have a picture album of the faces of everyone and the expressions they made when they taste their first fully ripened Sun Gold, because really no other tomato has the unique set of flavor characteristics. And they wind up in a lot of our recipes, including Lydia of Lydia's Italy makes a pesto trapanese, and we use Sun Gold. It is a cherry tomato pesto that's to die for.
Oh, and the trapanese pesto has almonds in it and basil. Oh, boy. Yeah.
The toasted almonds, the basil, the garlic. So that's number one. Number two, I'd have to say Cherokee Purple, partly because when you name a tomato and you don't really think anything of that moment except it needs a name, I know the story, and you send it to be shared. To be able to walk around a farmer's market anywhere in the country and see that tomato is a surreal, unbelievable experience. And it just happens to taste really darn good.
Right.
And then I'm going to mention one called Lillian's Yellow Heirloom. They average 1 to 1.25 pounds. It's the color of a canary. Lillian's would have to rank as the best tasting large tomato I have ever eaten. And that's really saying a lot, I think.
Yeah. What do you see coming? What are you working on now? And what do you see as the future in the world of tomatoes?
The future, we're going to go through the fads of the interesting colors. And right now we're starting to see the wonderful stripes that are coming out of wild boar farms in California and other amateur breeders. We're seeing the blue pigment getting worked into tomatoes.
Really? Huh.
From a wild tomato that had a dark blue pigment, Indigo Rose is one of the varieties. And it's not blue so much as a dark blueberryish purple where the sun shines on it. And they're still working on the flavors, but those are fads. Where I think it has to go is that heirlooms don't become something ethereal, something that just shows up on plates at restaurants, but we embed in the country the need to save seeds, to tell the stories. The Seed Savers came along at a perfect time 40 years ago. Their work is going to be never done, but how can we all help them? How can we identify the young people who are going to be really into gardening and growing tomatoes and seed saving that are going to be sitting in this seat in 20 or 30 or 40 years, so that we can maintain this incredible heritage that we've been blessed with, that we can partake of right now.
Craig, thank you. And thank you for all the tomatoes.
You're very welcome.
Craig LeHoulier is author of Epic Tomatoes. Now, put your tomato knowledge to work with this recipe for fresh heirloom tomato soup with cream. You'll find it at splendidtable.org. Oh, and don't forget to check out our list, 21 Things You Can Do with a Tomato, at splendidtable.org. Has a book ever made you so hungry you head straight for the kitchen when you're finished? You know the kind of book I mean. To Kill a Mockingbird with its Lane cake and Calpurnia's biscuits served every which way. Or Brideshead Revisited with its bowls of caviar and platters of blini. Well, you're not alone. Cara Nicoletti, butcher and author of Voracious, A Hungry Reader Cooks Her Way Through Great Books, has put together a collection of her favorite novels and the recipes that they inspired. Contributor David Leet swaps some favorite titles with her.
Welcome, Cara.
Thank you.
So I have to say that you put together two of my favorite subjects, eating and reading.
Yes.
So how did this idea for edible literature come about?
Well, food scenes from literature were, it's always been something that I've been sort of obsessed with since I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
I was really shy and I read a lot from a really young age and I connected really deeply to the characters that I was reading about. And to me, cooking the meals that they ate always felt like sort of a natural way to be closer to them and make them feel more real.
Uh-huh.
Some of my books from when I was a kid that I still have all the food scenes sort of marked up in them. And every once in a while, my mom would let me experiment with her in the kitchen, making pancakes from Pippi Longstockings and stuff like that. But it really didn't take off until I went to college and I was studying literature at NYU and I was working as a pastry chef and in a book club with my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I would make the meals from the book that we had just read. And then that sort of blossomed into a supper club where I would, you know, make big meals for strangers in my apartment that were based on literature. And then that.
And would you read from the books for those people when they came
to
the supper
club?
No,
but they would know. People, you know, everyone would bring their copy of the book and mm-hmm. sometimes they would read passages out loud to each other. But everyone knew really well, sort of, or they were anticipating what the food might be. And that was really fun. And then that I couldn't keep up with the demand for that.
Right.
I only did a handful of them. And that I turned that into a blog to keep up with it. And then it's just been ever since the last 5 or 6 years. I guess 7, including the book club, have just been cooking recipes from literature ever since.
So in talking about the book, you divide it into 3 sections. You have
yes.
childhood,
mm-hmm.
you have adolescence and college years, mm-hmm. and you have adult.
Yes.
Now, you have lost me entirely on childhood because I did not read Laura
Ingalls Wilder.
Ingalls Wilder or Pippi Longstocking or the Nancy Drew books.
Yeah.
I was desperate to read the Nancy Drew books. My mother forbade me.
Why?
From reading because boys did not read
Nancy
Drew.
Did you read
the
Hardy Boys instead?
That's what I had
yes.
to, but I was desperate to read Nancy Drew. But we did catch up in your adolescence.
Yes.
So what are some of the most memorable food scenes from that section of the book for you?
I think one of the most memorable, if not the most, was probably Rebecca.
Mm-hmm.
Both my parents were really wonderful about giving me books to read for comfort. And, you know, my mom would leave books on my bed for me if I was going through a hard time. And that was one of them. She left that book for me on my bed after I got my heart broken for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And the book kind of pulled me out of the stupor that I was in. It's a book about first love and about loss of identity. And there's a scene where the husband or the fiancé is proposing to her and this fly lands in the marmalade and she watches him sort of shoot away and then put that marmalade on his toast anyway. And I remember thinking when I was reading it, like, don't marry someone who does that. That's disgusting.
Don't marry the
but
man with the
does.
Fly.
Yeah. I think that was probably the most memorable from that section. Yeah.
What recipe connections between literature and the recipes you've included that you're most proud of in the book?
Mm. I think one of my favorites was the shrimp and mussel and cod stew from The Witches,
mm-hmm.
Roald Dahl, because there were a lot of books that I reread as an adult that really didn't hold up, and mm-hmm. that was one that really held up, and it was still just as magical as I remember it being when I was a kid. And that scene in particular, it made, you know, because you read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and you think, well, he's good at sort of making up magical foods and things like that, but that one, the grandmother is talking about being a young girl in Norway and eating straight off the fishing boats and sucking the heads of the shrimp out. And mm-hmm. it's a really beautiful scene and it makes you realize that he's a really good food writer and he's a really good writer just in
right.
general.
Any others?
I also really liked the cornbread from, I know I'm doing a lot of childhood books, but those were the ones that spoke to me the most. I think the cornbread from Where the Red Fern Grows was mm-hmm. really delicious. It's baked in a skillet and has honey butter, and the edges are really crisp, and it's a really good cornbread.
See, the one that got me, because mm-hmm. I read the book, was the Lord of the Flies and Porchetta di Testa,
yeah.
which I thought was great because, of course, there's the pig head on the stick.
Yeah. I was surprised Little Brown would let me do that, but I'm very grateful that they did.
Because, I thought that was really
and
awesome.
And it's a great recipe, too. It's really delicious.
So do you know if any of your readers from your blog have any plans of using Voracious as a guide for like a book supper club?
I really hope so. A big portion of my readers for the blog are people with book clubs. Mm-hmm. And they'll find the blog by Googling recipes for the goldfinch or something like that. So I think it would be amazing as a guide for people to read, you know, book club books, and then you'll have a recipe at the end to go along with it. But I am curious to see if people sort of pick and choose the books that they've already read, or if they go through it and use it as a guide of what to read. I'm not sure.
Name your top three most favorite books.
Of all time.
All time.
So this is always a difficult question for me because I always feel bad about my answer. My number one favorite book of all time is Pride and Prejudice.
Okay.
And I feel like people hate that answer.
And the recipe from that is what?
It's a white garlic soup. Okay. So I would say that's my favorite book of all time. I also, this is so hard, I loved The Goldfinch. Mm-hmm. I really did love The Goldfinch. And I cooked through that entire book on the blog. And then I would say the third is probably The Witches by Roald Dahl.
All right.
I would say.
Yeah. See, mine would be The World According to Garp.
Okay, that's a good one.
So you're
going
to have to get back to me about what I should cook from The World According to Garp.
I'll have to get back to you about that one. I'll have to reread it. I can't remember.
Well, Kara, it's been a pleasure having you on. Thank you.
It's been great. Thank you so much.
Kara Nicoletti is author of Voracious, A Hungry Reader Cooks Her Way Through Great Books. David Leet is the publisher of Leet's Culinaria, lccooks.com. Now take a look at Kara's recipe for an unusual goat cheese pumpkin pie. You know where it is, splendidtable.org. Coming up, a real challenge. An American pastry chef takes on the challenge of Japanese sweets. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Nicole Berman-Solo fell in love with the Japanese artisanal food culture while she was there studying business. Her logical follow-up? Come back to New York City and open Kyo Tofu, a Japanese-inspired dessert bar and restaurant. Now, this is a bit tricky since Japan's sweets have little resemblance to ours. So Melissa Clark talked with Nicole about how an American interprets the very different sweets of Japan.
Hello, Nicole. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
So, Nicole, are you making traditional Japanese sweets?
Well, when you say traditional Japanese sweets, I think what comes to mind is wagashi, which is traditional kind of beautiful, exquisite sweets that went with the tea ceremony. So now we're kind of going back hundreds and hundreds of years. And if you fast forward to today, Japanese sweets kind of run the gamut of course, there's still that wagashi, but then you'll find green tea cheesecake and Western desserts. And so I think we're kind of at the crossroads between using some traditional ingredients and components and then, kind of doing our own thing with Japanese ingredients.
And so what are some of the ingredients that you're using in your sweets?
We use things like miso, which is fermented soy paste. We use things like matcha, which is green tea, genmai, which is toasted brown rice, yuzu, which is a Japanese winter citrus, which is really delicious. And then, of course, we use a lot of soy, you know, tofu, soy milk, things like that.
You know, I've had miso soup, and it's a very savory flavor. How do you use that in a dessert?
Miso is great. It's one of my favorite ingredients of all time. And the reason that I like it so much is because, yes, it's salty, and it can be used as a salt replacer, but it has all kinds of interesting flavor dimensions to it. It has the umami. It has this kind of butteriness, a little bit of nuttiness. And so when you add it to something that goes well with something kind of salty and savory, like, say, chocolate or caramel, miso just adds this whole other dimension that you don't get with just straight salt.
I know in your book you have a recipe for miso brownies.
Oh, those are our number one bestsellers, hands down, the last 10 years, those miso brownies.
And can you use any color miso in them, or do you have to use white miso only?
I really like white miso, just, you know, not the not that kind of, like, mellower yellow miso and not the darker red miso. And the color, by the way, it not only comes from what's been fermented, but also how long it's been fermenting. And kind of like your most basic miso is like miso that you find in miso soup is just a regular white miso.
And what about, you mentioned matcha and you mentioned the green tea ceremony. So matcha is a very traditional Japanese ingredient, but you're also using it in newer ways?
Yeah, so matcha is a really, really very interesting ingredient. It's basically the best, nicest green tea leaves with all the kind of undesirable parts, the stems and things picked out by hand and then ground by a stone grinder. And it was historically used in the tea ceremony. It's the bitterness of matcha was supposed to remind us of the bitterness of life. And interestingly enough, matcha is always paired with a small sweet, a wagashi, to kind of balance out the bitterness of the matcha. So, you know, there's this history in Japan going back of matcha and sweets. And so, you know, fast forward to today, and you can find everything under the sun made with matcha, matcha pudding, matcha cheesecake, matcha muffins, matcha cookies. And we've kind of followed suit with that. And I would point anyone to our green tea creme brulee recipe, which was one of the most popular items on our menu.
And what about soy, tofu and soy milk? How are you using them?
You know, soy is, it's gotten a bad rap lately in the U.S., but it's such an amazing and versatile and vitamin-rich ingredient. And there are so many different things you can do with it, from the most basic using soy milk and tofu in things like puddings and cheesecakes and things like that, to using okara, which is the skins and the pulp of the soybean, in things like muffins and cookies as an egg replacer. It's just, there's many, many wonderful things you can do to, you know, take down the fat content, increase the protein and fiber content. And I think that utilizing things like soy and tofu lends a little bit of a, it's a little bit lighter than using like traditional dairy milk or butter.
You tell people to make their own soy milk in your book. Is that hard to do?
It's actually not. You just simply soak soybeans. I always recommend Japanese soybeans. They've always been non-GMO. They're absolutely beautiful. And you can get them in Japanese grocery stores or online. You soak them overnight, wash them, boil them, grind them down with a food processor or an immersion blender, and then use cheesecloth to strain out the okara that I mentioned, the pulp and the skins, and then you're left with the okara and you're left with soy milk.
That's great. So you get two things. You get the okara and you use those in muffins, and then you get the soy milk and you can use that in pudding or wherever else you'd use
soy milk. Sure. Yeah, all kinds of things. And then you can take it a step further and use the soy milk to make tofu.
We always think of tofu as being primarily a savory ingredient, but what do you do with it in sweets?
There's lots of uses for tofu in sweets, from just simply flavoring the sweet tofu to make almost like a healthier panna cotta, to using it as an ingredient in cheesecakes and custards and things like that. So it's really, it's super versatile. And you're probably familiar, there are lots of different kinds of tofu, depending upon the water content. So there's silken tofu, which has a very high water content, all the way up to very firm, which has had water drained out of it. And they all have different culinary applications.
And so for you, you use the softer one for more pudding-like things?
Well,
is that generally?
Well, sure, because we're doing a lot of, like I said, cheesecakes, custards, puddings. And so we do make our own silken tofu, and then we use that as an ingredient.
And you also mentioned yuzu. Now,
can you buy fresh yuzus here?
You
cannot. You cannot. Okay. I think a while back, somewhere in California, a few farms tried to actually plant yuzu and grow it fresh here, but after a few seasons, it didn't work. And you can't import fresh fruit from Japan. So, no, you can't get fresh yuzu, but you can buy juice, straight juice. You can buy rind. And if you're lucky, every once in a while, I can find like the frozen fresh rind, which is kind of cool.
And what about genmai? What's that?
Genmai is another really great ingredient. It is toasted brown rice. It's typically used as a tea. So the toasted brown rice kernels or grains, you would say, are kind of chunked up a little bit and sometimes combined with green tea leaves, sometimes not, and then brewed as a tea. And what we've done is taken just the brown rice grains, the toasted brown rice grains, ground them down a little bit, and they make a great ingredient in shortbread cookies and chocolates, you know, anywhere that you want to add both kind of a roasty, toasty flavor and also some texture, because they have a great crunchy texture.
Nicole, these are such great ideas. I cannot wait to try them. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
Nicole Vermonsolo is author of Kyo Tofu, Uniquely Delicious Japanese Desserts. Melissa Clark is a food columnist for the New York Times and author of Cook This Now. Now, Nicole left us with two recipes to try: dark chocolate brownies with miso and her chocolate souffle cupcakes. You can find them at splendidtable.org. It's the largest fruit native to the United States. The earliest Americans were eating it 19,000 years ago. Native Americans relished it, and the fruit sustained our earliest settlers. Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and John James Audubon were fans, and it even helped keep the Lewis and Clark expedition alive. With all this, you probably never heard of a pawpaw, let alone tasted one. That realization sparked writer Andrew Moore's question: what happened to the pawpaw and why? The answers are found in his new book, Pawpaw: In Search of America's Forgotten Fruit. He talked to our contributor Joe Yonan, who is food and dining editor of The Washington Post.
Hi, Andy. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Joe. Thanks for having me.
So I was so surprised to find out that the largest edible fruit native to the United States is a pawpaw.
That's right, which was something that struck me. How does something that's this big go largely unnoticed by most Americans? I learned that this wasn't actually always the case, that at one time Americans were entirely familiar with pawpaws, going back to the Native Americans who ate the fruit, who used the tree's fiber for cordage and rope, on down through the earliest explorers and colonists and pioneers. The pawpaw was an important fruit and food item each year in late summer.
And it actually is tropical.
That's right. In many ways, it's a tropical fruit that has willed itself to grow in the temperate north, to grow where it probably shouldn't. We know that over millennia it evolved to be here, but it is the only member of the tropical custard apple family that's not found in the tropics.
And in fact, here in America, there is something that you refer to as the pawpaw belt. Can you explain that for us?
Sure. The pawpaw belt is the term I use to refer to the states and regions where the pawpaw is native, where it grows wild. And that encompasses parts of 26 eastern states. And it spans from southern Louisiana to Ontario, Canada, and from the Atlantic west to the Mississippi, and into Oklahoma and even Nebraska.
Wow. What happened? Why did the pawpaw disappear from our tables?
Exactly. That's the big question. That was the mystery that I was trying to get at in the book, is how did Americans forget about this and why? And what I've come to is the easiest way to explain it is that when Americans stopped going to the woods for food, they stopped knowing the pawpaw.
Andy, what does a pawpaw taste like?
The pawpaw is commonly described as a cross between a mango and a banana. And that's true. But the first thing I like to describe is the texture. It has this tropical custard texture that's more similar to fruits you'd find in the Caribbean. Fruits like guanabana and cherimoya, custard apples. And the best thing you can do with a ripe, fresh pawpaw is just to eat it out of a hand. Cut it in half, scoop it out, and eat it like a custard in a cup, which is essentially what it is. But obviously, if you have a lot of pawpaws growing, if you've come across a bumper crop in the woods, you're going to want to do something with it. So the second best way to enjoy a pawpaw is pawpaw ice cream. It's one of the best ice cream flavors I've ever tasted.
Yeah, I saw that there's companies even like Zingerman's that are selling pawpaw ice cream, and there's even pawpaw beers, right?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
So how do I get my hands on pawpaws, Andy? How do we find them if we're not foragers, or do we need to be foragers to find them?
No, increasingly you don't need to be a forager to find a pawpaw. And if you're lucky, you might have pawpaws at your local farmer's market. More and more folks are setting pawpaws out in orchards and growing them like you would any other fruit. And then other farmers are realizing that they have this fruit growing in the woods that they can harvest and bring to market. So if you're lucky, you can go to your farmer's market and you might see a pawpaw grower, or you might see someone who has begun to gather these from the woods and offers them for sale. I think when you look at things like local food movements, the return to regional cuisines and regional foodways, I think people are naturally drawn to the pawpaw. And I think people are excited by the story of the pawpaw, and certainly they're excited by the taste of it. And they're excited to return to some of these food roots that connect them to, you know, their grandparents' generation or previous generations. And so I see a lot of things happening in the current climate of food and agriculture that bodes well for the return of pawpaws.
It's such an interesting story. Thank you so much, Andy, for coming to talk to us about it.
Thank you, Joe. It's good to be here.
Andrew Moore is author of Pawpaw, In Search of America's Forgotten Fruit. Joe Yonan is author of Eat Your Vegetables, Bold Recipes for the Single Cook. Now, Andrew left us with a classic recipe for pawpaw ice cream. It is the season. You can find the recipe at splendidtable.org. Coming up, your calls, and how does a designer with six kids think about the kitchen? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
I'm in the phone booth. It's the one across the hall. If you don't answer, I'll just ring it off the wall. I know he's there, but I just had a call. Don't leave me hanging on the telephone. Don't leave me hanging on the telephone.
It is time for us to connect. Get to us any way you can. Twitter, Facebook, send us an email, go to splendidtable.org, or actually call us, 800-537-5252. Elizabeth is calling from Catonsville, Maryland, and did I pronounce that correctly, Elizabeth?
Yes, you did. Hi, Lynn. It's so great to talk to you.
Well, it's good
so
to talk
honored.
To you.
it is September, and I hate to think of it, but the summer produce season is kind of coming to a close, and I just want to capture all those, like, the peaches and nectarines, local produce. I want to keep that, and I'm not much of a, I don't have any freezing techniques or any equipment like that. I just want something simple. How can I keep the flavor of summer through the fall and winter?
Well, you can actually, I mean, you could freeze, and you could just freeze in plastic bags. It's really easy. I do that with tomatoes.
Tomatoes?
I do that with tomatoes. I don't can tomatoes. I used to can tomatoes. And you know what? On an August day, you know, with the kitchen filled with steam, I give me a break. And what I love is I can slice up my tomatoes or just chunk them. And I put them in a, you know, a heavy-duty plastic bag. And I kind of squish it. I press out all of the air. I label it. You know, such and such heirloom tomatoes, or, you know, this kind, if it's one kind of tomato, et cetera. But I love working with heirlooms because the flavors can be so just extremely good. Anyway, you press out all the air, you zip it closed, and you can stack them, you know, let them freeze. And then once they're kind of flat, they'll be thick, but they're kind of flat, you can stand them up in the freezer, you can lay them down, but they're very easy to store. And you, boy, come January, you pull that out. Now, when you defrost this, and the same will be true for any other fruit, because remember, a tomato's a fruit. Okay. So when you defrost, it's going to be mushy. But the idea is you use it mushy. I mean, with tomatoes, you're going to be cooking them into a sauce or adding them to a soup or putting them in something that you're braising. But you'll get that bright, fresh flavor. And the same can be done with peaches and nectarines. Nectarines, I never peel. Peaches, you've got to peel because it's fuzzy. And that's not fun. Okay. But there's where you dip them in some hot water, you know, boiling water, just on a long fork, and you should be able to slip off the peel and run cold water over them, and the peel should come off. Give them about 30 seconds to a minute in the water. You don't want to cook them. And then slice them into wedges, cut them any way you want. And again, that same technique with the bags. And if you want to, you can sprinkle them with, you know, chili, or you can add a little allspice, which, by the way, is really great with stone fruit. But I rather do that when I take them out, you know, in the winter, and then I can fool with them however I want them.
Wonderful.
It's very simple.
It sounds easy.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, you don't need to light the stove. You don't need a pot. You don't need anything. And you have all this gorgeous stuff sitting there.
What about corn?
Corn, you have to parboil. Corn, you've got to parboil.
Okay.
Yeah, because with corn, there's an enzyme that if you just freeze it straight away, the flavor is really off. It's just not good. So with corn, I can't remember. If you look online, you'll find, you know, go to anything that says US.gov or something like EDU, and they'll tell you about freezing corn.
That sounds real simple, and I'm just looking so forward to doing it so I can hold on to all those flavors during the wintertime.
Yeah, well, I don't know about you, but right now we're still getting small, sweet green beans, and they're not going to taste that way again until next year.
So get them stocked
away. So, okay, I think you're launched.
Thank you so much, Lynn. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
And a pleasure for me. Thank you. Thank you. You take care.
Take care.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
I've got a question about lemongrass. Someone sent us an email saying they see it in lists of ingredients. They see it in the market, but they said, what do you do with it? How do you use it? Well, the part that's actually going to go into your food is sort of the core of the lemongrass. So it's a tall, long stalk with leaves that are very tightly wrapped around the base of it. And then they kind of open up into long, narrow leaves. Now, everything on that plant has a delicate lemon flavor. So as you strip off those leaves, that's what you're going to do because you want to get down to this nice core. Save them or chop them up and freeze them because they're going to make wonderful tea. Or they're going to flavor dishes. You can put them in a thing of cheesecloth and put them into a dish to flavor it and then pull them out. But this is what you do. Cut away and peel off all of the outer stalk that you can, okay? And you'll get down to essentially the core, which will be very pale green and like a narrow pencil. And that is what you actually use when you're making a curry or you're making a marinade. And it's very tough. So you trim off the root end and then you can slice it or you can just chop it up and throw it into a food processor and really get it ground up. That's the key to it, because otherwise it's very chewy. So get it really ground up well and then add it to a marinade. For instance, Thai fish sauce, a lot of lemongrass, like about 3 stalks of lemongrass, because what you're actually going to be cutting, the actual dowel, like a pencil, is about the length of a pencil. That's the part that's going to be the best for cooking, because beyond that, it gets kind of reedy. So if you have 3 of those and you chop them up and you make them, you know, very, very, very finely minced, throw in some fish sauce, a tablespoon or two, some sugar, a tablespoon or two, some fresh lime, a tablespoon or two, and those 3 minced stalks of lemongrass, maybe a little bit of garlic. And that is a dynamite marinade. You can put that on anything. You can put it on eggplant. It's delicious on fish or seafood of any kind. And it's wonderful on just about any meat or poultry. And you just grill it or roast it or steam it. So that's basically how you handle lemongrass. 800-537-5252. We have someone calling from Austin, Texas. It's Sissy. Sissy, what is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I was wondering if you had any great recommendations for marinating fresh mozzarella balls.
Oh, boy. Well, okay. One of the classic ways of keeping them, of course, is in essentially a brine, a little bit of salt and water, okay? Or in whey, which is, you know, when you make cheese, the solids of the milk separate from the liquid of the milk, and the liquid of the milk is the whey, and the whey is kind of acidic, and that acts as a little bit of a preservative. And sometimes you'll see the mozzarella balls. Have they come actually packed in water?
Yes, in they liquid? Come packed in water. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, that liquid may have some whey in it, or it may have some acid in it, and that helps preserve the cheese. So you kind of want to keep it that way and then marinate just before, you know, maybe the night before you're going to serve it. One of the marinades that's really lovely is a classic. It's things like minced fresh herbs. And it could be a little bit of rosemary, a little bit of thyme, a tad of oregano that you mince. You might mix some green onion in there, a bit of olive oil, and just a tad of lemon. And you toss that with the mozzarella, and you just let it sit for a couple of hours in the refrigerator. And when you serve it, you could have tomatoes with it. You could just do it straight with some chunks of bread. So that's one way you can do it. Now, another thing you can do with it is cut it in little cubes and just roll it in minced herbs. So you have a basil cube and you have a rosemary cube and you got a savory cube and you've got a chive cube. And then you arrange that on a plate and then you could take any fruit you want and dress that fruit with something like oil and vinegar or even a creamy dressing. Dress the fruit in a little bit of buttermilk. You know, with herbs and that kind of thing, sort of a homemade ranch style dressing, very little of it, just a little. And then serve that with the little cubes, with the herbs. And people take a little bit of each and put it on a slice of bread or just eat it with a knife and fork. And it's really tasty. So that's a couple of ways that you can play around with it. Does that work for you?
It sure does. Thank you so much for those ideas. I love them all.
You know what? I just remembered one other thing, and this is a classic. You know, in Italy, it's said that mozzarella has 24 attributes and it loses one each hour. The point being, if it's at all possible, you use it as fresh as possible. And what's done with day-old mozzarella, in at least parts of southern Italy, is that little bits of it are put into good heavy cream. And then they're wrapped in fresh today's mozzarella. And it's called burrata. It's become very fashionable in the United States. But you can skip the outer wrapping, cut up the mozzarella, and just pour heavy cream over it and let it soak in that overnight. And then the next day, take it out and put it on picks or just arrange it on a plate or toss it into a salad. It is out of this world. Yeah, it's cream on cream. It's very, very good. So there you go. You can use that mozzarella until the cows come home, if you'll pardon the pun.
Yes, wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome. Enjoy. Take care.
Okay. You too.
Bye. By the way, great mozzarella, how to buy great mozzarella, ideally you want it to smell like sweet milk. It should have a little bit of a soft center. And it should taste like the sweetest, freshest milk you could possibly imagine. That is a great, great mozzarella. Remember, you can get to us anytime. Facebook, Twitter, call us 800-537-5252. Gabrielle Blair is the voice behind the popular blog Design Mom. It's devoted to the intersection of motherhood and design. It's an unusual take that she's well suited for. She's a graphic designer with 6 children. She's pulled together her thoughts on kids and design into a book, Design Mom, How to Live with Kids, a room-by-room guide. Our contributor, Patty Hinnage, talked to Gabrielle about how the way you plan your space can affect the relationships you have with your kids.
Gabrielle, so one of the surprises for me from your book was that you once tore down a wall yourself, your kitchen, right?
It's true. It's true. And it happened late at night with a flurry of hammers and sledgehammers with my husband. The kitchen was kind of isolated from the dining area and the living room by a 3-quarter wall. And I didn't think much of it when we moved in. It was like, great, there's a lot of storage in this kitchen, terrific. But after a couple of weeks, I realized we were no longer prepping meals as a family or even cleaning them up as a family because the kitchen was so isolating. And just one night said, I've had enough. And we started tearing down the wall. And immediately there was a difference. You know, we threw up a temporary folding table as we decided if we were going to do a kitchen island or what we would do instead of that wall. But immediately there was a difference in how much we were interacting, how we were working together, how much conversation we were having on a daily basis. And that was a big deal and such a reminder that design decisions can affect relationships and can affect the whole atmosphere in your house.
Now, going into your kitchen, you know, I am not a fan of microwaves. And I was so happy to see that you tell people that they should really assess whether they need a microwave or not. Now, how do you think they should assess?
Well, for me, it happened. This whole thinking started when we moved to France. And this was several years ago. And we moved into a house. It was a furnished house. And there was no microwave. And that was the first time since I was maybe, you know, 5 years old that I lived in a place without a microwave. And it definitely threw me off at first because I had certain habits that were tied to the microwave. Namely, I would warm up like baby food, and we had a baby at the time. So it took me a couple weeks to realize, oh, people used to have to warm up food before microwaves existed. And there are ways to do this that I didn't grow up with, but that exist. And it took me a minute to get into a new rhythm. But once I did, I really actually loved it and realized that I was less likely to buy quick microwavable food, you know, something like frozen burritos or frozen corn dogs, you know, that kind of stuff that you throw into the microwave, mm-hmm. since I didn't have one. And so I was more likely to turn to better food alternatives. And so when we moved into the house here and there wasn't a microwave, that was totally fine with us. Mm-hmm. And it was, again, this chance to say, oh, this is a great way to keep better eating habits. Although I confess, we did end up buying a very small microwave, mm-hmm. At my kids' request, and it's on a little shelf in the pantry out of the way, hopefully not taking up too much space.
Right. Now, talking about space and storage, you advocate small refrigerators, but you have a big family. You have 6 kids.
It's true.
What does that imply with shopping and preparing meals? How often do you shop, and do you really have a small fridge?
Right. So I would say my fridge is average size. It's definitely not what people expect when they hear we have 6 kids. They assume we're going to have something oversized. But what I found is, and this may be true for others too, is that when I had a big fridge and I was buying food in bulk, like a huge jar of pickles or a big container of ketchup or whatever it might be, that it would get about half used. And by that time, the bottle's looking really grimy and kind of gross, and we'd end up opening a new bottle that looked fresher and cleaner. And so then you'd have like half-filled bottles in the fridge, and the fridge would look full when you opened the door, but really there wasn't much in there that was actually usable and good. So we finally figured out that if I buy a small jar of ketchup or mustard or pickles or whatever it might be, that we use the whole thing up. So there's actually less waste, doesn't take up much space, and we're much more likely to buy our food that we're going to eat that day. And I realize that isn't convenient for everyone in every town. But again, for us, it's made it so that we eat healthier meals.
So, Gabrielle, what do you want your kitchen to feel like to your family?
That's a great question. I want my kitchen to feel like, I want my kids to feel really welcome there. I want them to understand that this is their home as much as it is mine, and that they are welcome to the kitchen. So I try to keep what they would need, the most common items they would need, at their level. So, and right now, obviously, I have the youngest kids in mind. My older ones are teenagers and they can reach whatever they want. But for the younger kids, the plates, the cups, the silverware, the bowls, those are all below counter level in either drawers or lower shelves. And so when they're reaching for to get a snack for themselves, they can get it. But also when they're emptying the dishwasher, setting the table, whatever it might be, they have access to those dishes. And the same thing goes for snacks. If we keep the snacks that we want them to go to, if we keep those accessible at their eye level, it makes a big difference. And I've even gone so far as to, you know, as I'm setting up the kitchen, deciding where things will go, get down to their level, you know, crouch down, get on your knees, whatever it takes to sort of see the world from their height and figure out what would make sense for them.
Gabrielle, thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Thank you for having me. This was really fun.
Gabrielle Blair is the author of Design Mom, How to Live with Kids, a Room-by-Room Guide. Now, you can find an excerpt from her book at splendidtable.org. Patty Hinnich is host of Patty's Mexican Table on PBS. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. See you here next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Chili Davis, who said, growing old is mandatory. Growing up is optional. SplendidTable.org has just about everything you're ever going to need. And if you like what you heard today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app. You can listen anytime it's convenient for you. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.